Healthcare's forgotten patients. Millions of Americans left to languish in prison or survive without treatment on the street. As the nation struggles to reform healthcare, who's fighting on behalf of the mentally ill in America? And is anyone in Washington listening?
These are the dark ages for people who are severely mentally ill.
People with severe mental illness used to be housed in state-run asylums. But in the 70s, most of those were closed down. The doors simply flung open, their patients released. But to where? Many to the streets, and that often led into the hands of the law. So that hospitals were replaced by jails, and those who would have been patients are now inmates. I'm Josh Rushing. This week on Fault Lines, we go deep inside one of the nation's largest prison systems to examine the criminalization of the mentally ill.
I think it's a very bad commentary on the state of our society that we are not taking care of the people who are least able to take care of themselves.
In a way, we're going backwards in time. We're going back to an era when we treated mentally ill people in a jail setting.
Often these people who are mentally ill in jails are beaten by other prisoners, sometimes beaten by guards, sometimes left for days in solitary confinement, hallucinating. It's a very serious and a very tragic situation that we have.
The prisons are not really set up to manage the mental illness. Most prisons are brick and mortar institutions, and their main thing is to serve and protect. And they just want to keep you from getting out.
We are making criminals out of people without enough mental capacity to be responsible for what they do.
It's like having cancer. It's an illness.
And do you think you should be punished for that?
No. No, I think I should be helped.
They're psychotic, delusional, and often paranoid. But to understand how people with mental illness came to make up more than half the U.S. prison population, you need to start here, in the nation's parks, bus stations, and streets. Homelessness has become a part of the landscape in nearly every major city in America. But if you look closely at the individuals forced to live on the street, it's often more than just poverty at play. No one knows exactly what percentage of the homeless suffer from mental illness. Some advocacy groups estimate the number could be as high as 80%. It's a sad reality that for many leads to eventual confrontations with the law. Houston, Texas, the fourth largest city in America, has one of the nation's largest homeless populations. Incidents across the country where police officers have shot and killed mentally ill individuals have forced law enforcement here to rethink their approach.
You know, as years pass, we decided to take advantage of the resources in the community, specifically in the mental health community, and now we are much more professional in our response, in that we realize that jail is not the answer.
To see how this new program works, Fault Lines followed some of these specially trained teams into action.
Hey! How y'all doing?
Houston's home to the nation's largest CIT unit. CIT stands for Crisis Intervention Teams. The program partners cops with mental health clinicians.
It's not trying to get anybody on the spot whatsoever, but what we're trying to do is help. I want to make sure you're okay, all right?
Steve Augustine is a CIT officer with 15 years in the Houston Police Department.
Okay, look, I'm just going to make sure you don't have any weapons on you, okay? You okay, all right? I'm not your enemy, okay? You're not going to jail. You're just going to the hospital, okay? Just going to the hospital. Just for safety measures, okay?
This man was found by the police wandering through traffic on a downtown street.
Obviously, he's in crisis. So we're going to take him down to MPC, and MPC is basically going to get him stabilized, all right? And then basically later on, They take him to the hospital and then probably released out so he can, you know, start life over again.
Starting over may be tougher than it seems. This man may be headed to a hospital today, but too often public hospitals are underfunded and overcrowded, meaning that if they offer any psychiatric services at all, it's only for the short term.
I'm gonna let the window down so it won't be so hot, okay?
Meanwhile, long-term state facilities have all but disappeared over the years. Fewer than 40,000 Americans currently reside in psychiatric hospitals, while according to the Department of Justice, 30 times that number, a whopping 1.25 million mentally ill, are serving time in U.S. jails and prisons.
If we had the same number of people in the state psychiatric hospitals today, based on population, as we had 40, 50 years ago, there would be over 1 million people in the state mental hospitals.
Is it fair to say jails are the new asylums?
Oh, there's no question jails are the new asylums. As I mentioned, I have tried to find a single county in the United States. We have over 3,000 counties in the United States where the hospital still has more mentally ill people than the jails. In every county that I can find, the jail has more mentally ill people in the hospital.
The Harris County Jail in Houston is no exception. 130,000 inmates a year pass through these cells, and the jail has recently made significant changes to improve conditions for the mentally ill. At any given time, it doses 2,500 inmates with psychotropic drugs, making it the largest mental health facility in Texas.
If you're in jail generally, it's not a great bargain. I mean, jails are not something you sign up for on it. If you're in jail and psychotic, where you're hearing voices, where you're delusional, it's a living hell.
A hell that's all too familiar to mother of three and inmate Shannon Holton.
I have post-traumatic stress disorder, OCD, schizophrenia, insomnia.
Shannon was arrested on charges of drug possession.
When I'm off my medication, that's what my psychiatrist told me, that I self-medicate when I don't take my medicine.
This is her 26th time behind bars.
I can't handle it. It's very, it's real loud. It's a lot of chaos, fighting, all of that. I mean, I have a really bad anxiety disorder where I pull my hair out when my anxiety gets real high. And it's real, real hard to deal with for me.
Life is no easier for Andre Bonnier. He's illiterate and has been living on the streets for the last 15 years. He's in jail here for the 31st time.
Yeah, I've been diagnosed with schizophrenic, mental retardation, mental disturbed. But my brain's abnormal too, you know, at times. And my brain gets abnormal.
When he got here a week ago, he was a completely different person from what you were able to see today.
It's like, you know, because I haven't had my nerve pills, my nerve medication, you know.
He was extremely aggressive, so aggressive that he had to be brought directly over from processing, had been off his meds, was combative, threatening, hostile, throwing feces, really in a regress state, very, very out of control. And it took a couple of days and getting him back on his medications for him to kind of mellow out and come back to the person that he is.
Andre's been charged with assaulting a family member, although he claims to have no recollection of it.
So do you understand the process, like what you'll plead? And
No, I don't understand the plea and all that.
Given the choice, would you rather be in a mental hospital or a jail or prison hospital?
I'd rather be in a hospital.
Well, I think this is intended to be a jail, not a treatment center. As much as we try, we create an environment, I think, that's as therapeutic as possible. It's staffed with professionals. The security is a backup, but they're not the predominant caregivers in these cell blocks. But it's still not a hospital setting.
Andre's treatment has greater consequences than just his mental well-being. The jail is trying to prepare him for his trial.
We have to err to the conservative side and be as aggressive as we can to restore his competency so that he can participate in his own defense. And so it is very different to plead to a trespassing charge and serve a 3-day sentence and plead guilty to a very serious charge, which could land you in prison for many years.
If that happens, Andre will be transferred into the Texas prison system, where inmate Charlie Brink, who's bipolar, says things get much worse.
What do you think about the treatment you're getting in here, the medical treatment?
I think it sucks. I really don't think it's enough. I think people with mental illnesses should be, talked to more often, I guess, and see what's going on in their heads.
The Texas prison system has more than 150,000 inmates in 112 units across the state. This facility, the Luther Unit, has only two psychiatric staff to handle more than 1,300 inmates. Charlie is serving a 7-year sentence for drug charges. He gets to see the doctor once every 6 months.
And you go into the room and you look at a big screen TV and he's there on the TV and he can see you. But it's just not the same as talking to someone in person.
While direct contact with a doctor may be rare, prescription medications seem to flow through the correction system without a problem.
Depakote,
Risperdal,
Lexapro,
Geodon,
Vilify,
Neurontin,
Zyprexin,
Thorazine,
Trazodone,
Lithium.
There's a long list.
Vilify,
Haldol.
I can't think of all the names.
That's it for now.
The Texas Department of Criminal Justice refused numerous requests to speak with fault lines on camera about its mentally ill population behind bars. These cases raise a difficult question for the criminal justice system. When the severely mentally ill break the law, should jails exist to help or punish them?
We see a huge level of need, and we don't have the ability to turn our backs. We have to address the issues that are here. The purpose is to serve criminal justice needs. I think our purpose here is to provide treatment. And so we have to find that balance of providing treatment within this milieu. It's really not a therapeutic, though, environment.
I don't know. To me, prisons for people like, child molesters and rapists and murderers, it seems like we're not even treated like people here.
The Rosewood Center, near Baltimore, Maryland. Founded in 1888 as an asylum and training school for the feeble-minded, places like this one were later described by journalists as snake pits, often holding and medicating people against their will. Starting in the 1960s, these institutions fell victim to politics from the left and the right. Conservative politicians like California Governor Ronald Reagan were pressing for state budget cuts to reduce the size of what they called the welfare state. At the same time, civil liberties groups began an aggressive campaign against involuntary commitment, calling it a violation of patient civil rights.
So it was a very peculiar mix, strange bedfellows of some people from the far left, civil libertarians, some people from the far right saying, let's save money, we don't need to take care of these people, both of whom pushing at the same time, and that's how the hospitals got emptied.
Lawyers and politicians argued that the mentally ill would do better in society, treated as outpatients by community health centers. But the idea never got off the ground.
The whole idea behind deinstitutionalization turned out to be very well-meaning, but a disaster because the plans were not made for what was going to happen to the people when they left the hospitals. Now we've opened up the hospitals, let everybody out, and now they're all on your inner cities and your towns and on the streets and the homeless shelters and in the jails and prisons. We're much more aware of them now because they're living in the community. It's a major black mark. And I think the whole deinstitutional movement is going to go down in history as one of the great social disasters of the 20th century.
Madam Speaker,
the President of the United States.
For months now, the debate over health care has dominated the domestic agenda, reaching fever pitch in September when the President took his case to Congress.
I'm not the first president to take up this cause, but I am determined to be the last.
But advocates say mental illness has been conspicuously absent from the conversation.
there is almost no discussion of the mentally ill in those discussions on it. It's low on the priority list. I mean, how many legislators have we had in Washington who say, I am really going to defend the rights of the severely mentally ill? The mentally ill as a bloc don't vote, and they certainly don't have money, and they don't contribute $100,000 to your senator's campaign on it.
Instead, the administration has been touting the so-called parity legislation, which will require private insurance companies to cover mental illness.
So I am a supporter of the idea of mental health parity, where insurance companies have to provide basic coverage for basic health care needs.
But critics point out people who are homeless or in prison often don't have access to insurance, and the legislation doesn't address the real problem.
The number of severely mentally ill people who will be helped by the parity bill, which everyone thought was wonderful to pass, probably I can count on the fingers of one hand. It's going to have very, very little effect on the seriously mentally ill.
Catherine Power is the director of the Center for Mental Health Services. She's the highest ranking federal official responsible for protecting the interest of the mentally ill.
Why do you think we have so many people with mental illness in prison rather than in hospitals?
I have a very small program. My jail diversion program is a $10 million program. That's not a very big program. And a $10 million program, we can fund perhaps 5 or 6 communities in the United States. We have much more demand than we do actual resources. And what happens is that we make those arguments to our bosses, and our bosses make those arguments to their bosses, and you end up receiving the appropriations that you receive. And I don't think anybody's proud of the fact that people with mental illnesses are not getting all of those kinds of care. But I think we just have to look at resources and collaboration in a way that hopefully will be new and hopeful, and I believe that.
And I dare anyone or anything to try and overcome us when we're of one mind with God.
Amen.
Okay? On three, the word is Jesus. 1, 2, 3.
Jesus!
Y'all have a great life.
2 hours north of Houston, the Huntsville unit, the oldest prison in Texas, releases dozens of prisoners every day. And every day, Bill Clyburn greets them.
Welcome back, guys.
Thank you very much.
Just go straight ahead. There's some church volunteers to help you up there. Welcome back, man.
Welcome back, where?
The free world, brother.
Himself a former inmate with bipolar disorder, Bill trains volunteers to be the first point of contact.
We're brothers, man. Okay, look, you want to go down here. Here's the first stop sign.
Offering a hand of support for newly released prisoners as they prepare to step out into the world. For some, just finding their way to the nearest bus station can seem like an impossible task.
Can I see your bus ticket? I want to make sure you know what's going on.
Ray's getting out of prison today after spending the last 17 years behind bars.
And he was going to Tyler, Texas, which means he'll get on the bus here and go to Dallas and wait for 2 hours and 15 minutes and catch the bus to Tyler, if he can stay focused that long. And he'd arrive in Tyler at 9:15 or 10 o'clock. Is that your mama?
No, my wife.
Your wife? All right. But fortunately, he found the phone number for his wife, and we called her, and she's gonna meet him at the Dallas bus station, and he might make it. This man
named Weatherford just served a 10-year sentence.
Call me, okay?
Yeah, because I'm on a psych med.
What kind of psych meds are you on?
Trazodone, olanzapine.
You could tell he had some kind of learning disability. And from the list of medications he traipsed off, bipolar, he had some kind of psychotic disorder. He was taking some kind of psychiatric medicines for psychotic disorders. So we were able to take him over. We gained his confidence. We gave him some shirts. We didn't have pants that fit him, but he sure loved that cowboy hat, didn't he? If you need more help, you call me, okay?
All right.
Eric Strawhacker got out of prison in April of this year. He volunteers with Bill to help mentally ill prisoners recently released.
I talked to one guy here last Friday, and he said he was going to a homeless shelter, and that's kind of hard.
In addition to coping with his mental illness, Eric now faces the additional stigma of being a convicted felon.
Now you have to put on your application if you have a felony, and when places get a stack of applications about that high, they have to do a criminal background check, and most just throw them away because they don't want to have to. They cost the company money to do that.
Well, Father, we bless you in the name of Jesus. We thank you.
Bill and his volunteers have their work cut out for them, a handful of well-meaning individuals in the shadow of a massive system.
It's really a travesty that we would take mentally ill people and cycle them through incarcerations. They're just cycled through there as big human warehouses.
Unplug it, unplug it.
Come spend a day with me at the bus station and see the human garbage we have created. A lot of those men were not like that when they went in there. And I'll take you into some of these prisons, and they walk around like zombies. If I didn't believe that we could change it, I wouldn't be doing this every day. I know we can do it. We've solved other things, and we can solve these problems too. It's just a matter of becoming involved.
The healthcare discussion has become as ugly of a partisan debate as any in recent U.S. history. Yet when it comes to the treatment for the mentally ill, it's clear the status quo is both dangerous and inhumane. Without the support of major lobbyists or the backing of corporate dollars, is the situation reversible? Or will the severely mentally ill continue to be forgotten?
Oh, I think our era will be regarded with a great deal of wonderment as to why they allowed all those mentally ill people to be on the streets, how the jails got so full of. They won't understand how this could have happened.
We got to do more. You know, we cannot continue to force this on the police or the criminal justice system. It's just not the correct thing to do.
We as a community have got to come together and tell our legislators, hey, we're tired of all this money for prisons. Come on, let's do the right thing here.
I will take every dollar. I will take every quarter. I will take every nickel devoted to mental health, because that means that we won't have to go through the expensive thing of locking somebody up in a torturous situation, paying $30,000 a year to see them abused.
What you need is you need leadership. You need both professional leadership within the psychiatric profession. You also need political leadership. You need governors, you need someone in the White House or someone in the Department of Health and Human Services who says, this is a problem that we can solve and we're going to solve it. We have not had that.